My name is Saul Slapikoff, and I'm here to welcome you from the Boston Committee on the Middle East and on behalf of the other organizations that have sponsored the program, whose names are listed on the blackboard over there, and I'll read them off. BCOM, the Boston Committee on the Middle East, Grassroots International, American Friends Service Committee, Boston Mobilization for Survival, the Arab American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, Massachusetts Chapter, Visions of Peace with Justice in Israel-Palestine, the Boston Area New Jewish Agenda, the National Lawyers Guild, and the MIT Anthropology Program. This program was planned a long time before what has transpired since Sharon's visit to the Haram al-Sharif. And if you can call it luck, is that we had a program with two knowledgeable people to be able to talk about what is going on now in Palestine, Israel. The two people that we have are going to speak in the order that they're sitting from. Saad Dajani from Grassroots International. She's the Middle East and Horn of Africa area person for Grassroots and travels frequently to the area. And sitting to her right is Allegra Pacheco, who is an Israeli human rights attorney who spends time trying to defend Palestinians in Israeli courts and is here for a year at the Bunten. If you're lucky and careful, you may have read some of her op-ed pieces. There was one that appeared in the Boston Globe sometime last November, I think, and one more recent one in the New York Times. And she's managed in those short pieces to pack incredible amounts of information in. So I think we're fortunate to have them both here. Now, the format for tonight is each speaker will have up to 20 minutes, and I'll warn them when they have 5 minutes left and when they have 1 minute left. And after both of them have spoken, we will open this up for questions and discussion. Each person from the floor will have a minute to ask a lengthy question or to make a one-minute comment. If it turns out that there aren't that many hands up on this issue, we may extend it. But I want to make sure that we have enough time for everybody in the audience to take part in the discussion and question period. And so let me introduce Saad Dajani from Grassroots International.
Thank you. Well, I'm happy to see everybody here, even though the circumstances aren't that pleasant. I'm told that none of these are microphones, so I have to project my voice. So if people can't hear, please come to the front, and I'll try to speak as loudly as I can. I want to start by making an analogy, which may sound a bit strange, but hopefully you'll get the point. Remember in 1993 when Hillary Clinton came up with the new health care proposal for this country, and people blasted her and criticized her and said at the time, but she's not an elected official, so why does she have a right to come up with a health care policy for this country? And one of the things that struck me at the time was I thought, wow, what a great smokescreen. And I started thinking, but what about all the people they're not asking about, the gray suits, so to speak, the voiceless, faceless people, the heads of CEOs, the CEOs, lobbyists, head of insurance companies, drug companies, and just thinking about who really makes policy or what is going on the ground that is reality, the intersections between different political and economic interests that may not always be visible, but in fact have more of an impact, surround our lives, affect our lives, maybe even more so than the public face of policy. And Fast forward a couple of years to the, or a few years to the recent demonstrations against the World Trade Organization in Seattle, more recently in D.C., in Prague, and so on. And I could see this, and I'm sure all of you did too, this emergence of an understanding of what is really at work, that it's not just our elected politicians who are calling the shots, but there's something else. It's connection and intersection of political, economic, and other kinds of interests that affect our lives in this country and overseas, in labor, environment, and so on and so forth. And you can call this a matrix of control. And for those of you who keep up with the news from the territories, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. What I'm getting at is that sometimes what is not immediately visible may have an impact on our lives, perhaps more so than what is visible in certain areas. And for the most part, too, what is invisible, you know, something happens in the healthcare field or in banking or in economics, and they all seem random and spread out and individual. And yet, if we put all the picture together, we get a scenario of the globalized economy and how it's working. Usually not, it doesn't need brute force. You can just see it spreading tentacles without the use of brute force. And what I want to talk about here is exactly the same scenario having occurred in the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza over many, many years, but especially since the peace process, so-called peace process, started in 1993. What has been invisible to people here in the U.S., unless you want to bother to go and look for it, is this increasing spread of Israeli control over the West Bank and Gaza Strip, economically, politically, infrastructure, and so on. A growing matrix of control that has trapped Palestinians and put them in the bind therein so that the revolt of today may make a bit more sense. I want to say a few points that I'm not going to have time to go into much detail, and maybe later in question and answer we can discuss them in more detail. One of the points I want to suggest to you is that the peace process that started in 1993 was, to use a phrase, war by other means. Again, this sort of spreading of control that did not originally require brute force to be imposed on the Palestinians. I want to also suggest to you that unlike it is popularly assumed that Palestinians, or that the failure of the peace process is what caused Palestinians to revolt today and Israel to try to crush it with the force that it's using, it is rather that the peace process is unfolding almost exactly as was planned, believe it or not. And rather than being flawed in its implementation, it's flawed in its very conception. And because, let me skip to another point. The reason why Israel is using the force that it is using right now, and I want to argue that it's not in response to the immediate violence as is being promoted, but because even the Palestinians, even Arafat during his meetings in Camp David in July was not able to capitulate to the extent that Israel wanted it to. And so the economic and political appeasements that they've gotten over the 7 years was not enough. And so at this point, Israel has decided to use force to stake its claims to what it wants. And I'll go further than that and say that the roots of this conflict isn't about even Oslo. Oslo, I believe, is flawed. But Palestinians for the last 52 years have never been offered a peace proposal that would meet their legitimate national and human rights. I was in the occupied territories in September, and I'll just tell you here bits and pieces of that visit. We took a delegation there, and at one point we went to the settlement of Efrat, which is in the news occasionally. It's sort of south of Jerusalem, sort of west of Bethlehem. And Keep in mind Efrat because it's one of the settlements that is going to be combined with others in the area into a big block that Israel is going to annex in the final settlement with the Palestinians. And while we were there, they brought this spokesperson to take us around and talk to us, and he's a guy who turns out to be from Chicago, and presented himself as a nice, peaceful family man who was coming back to his homeland and wanted to live in peace with his Arab neighbors, and he kept calling them neighbors even though they were the settlement is situated on a lot of Palestinian-owned land. And fine, at one point I asked him a question, and I said, well, you're from Chicago, you're American, you're from Chicago, yes. And I said, all right, I'm American too, and my parents are from Jaffa. They were kicked out in 1948. And I said, well, just like you feel that you're coming back to a homeland that you consider yours, I would like to come back to my homeland. I would like myself and my parents to have the choice of going back to Jaffa. And so he started stumbling over his words and trying to debate history and so on. And then he finally said, I have no problem with you coming back. And I said, well, good. So you also would accept my brothers, sister, parents, cousins, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, all 5 million of us? No, 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 no. That's not workable. And I think this is the essence of the issue. For in 1948, as most of you probably know, Palestine was turned into the state of the Jewish people, Israel. Three-quarters of the population, Palestinians, were kicked out. And today there are about 5 million Palestinian refugees. They do not have the minimum, as I said, of their rights addressed in the Oslo process. I think that for anybody who wants to understand the situation and wants to figure out what are the components of a just peace, nothing can be done, or there can be no just peace, without taking into account this fundamental injustice of a population whose land was taken from under their feet and whose rights were never restored. There is nothing, and I want to mention a few things about the Oslo process that led us to where we are today. There's nothing in Oslo, and by Oslo I mean all the agreements that were signed since 1993, nothing in Oslo that addresses or restores the rights of refugees to return home, which is the basic right of all people and is enshrined in international law. All right, other things about Oslo that I think are important that may explain where we are today. In none of the accords, and you can read them, in none of the accords is Israel acknowledged as an occupier. So we have 1948, where a whole population was displaced, expelled, and denied their homeland. And you have an occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip in 1967 that the whole world recognizes as occupation. But in the accords, the peace deal, there is no mention of Israel being an occupier. So based on that, in the last 7 years, Israel was able to use a peace process that where it's not even mentioned as an occupier, to institutionalize and entrench its occupation instead of remove it. And that's part of where we are today. And there are many manifestations of that. And then please do consider this idea of this matrix of control, because you would hear in the New York Times or on NPR, a settlement was built, a bypass road was carved, a home was demolished, there was closure, people were denied permits. Now there's safe passage. But add them all together and you have something which is like a trap again around the Palestinian population in the West Bank and Gaza that affects every aspect of their daily life. For example, going into the Gaza Strip, maybe some of you have been there, you cross a checkpoint called Erez. And the people who are foreigners, Israelis, settlers, VIPs, the Palestinians who are with the authority or have various positions, can go through a nice terminal, which is right there on the road. It's air-conditioned, polite soldiers behind the counter, take your passport, and let you in. The average Palestinian resident of Gaza has to go through something which is really a cattle run that goes from the Palestinian checkpoint right to the the point of Eretz, where then you take a bus or car or whatever and go to Israel for work or wherever you're going to work. And in many other ways, too, Palestinians need permits to be able to cross into Israel or into Jerusalem to get to work, to visit family, to go to hospitals, and so on. I mean, there are so many aspects of this daily life where, instead of being removed, the occupation has been entrenched even further, and Palestinians are facing daily humiliation. We hear in the news that, well, the Palestinians now have 40% of the West Bank for self-rule. That's not quite true. In fact, their areas of self-rule, and there may be some maps over there and you can look at them, their area of self-rule, Area A, is about 18% of the West Bank.
The dark green on this map.
Yeah, I think there are some over there. Somebody brought some. The dark green here, but they've expanded slightly, so you can come up later and look. Joint control, which means that Palestinians have control over civilian issues and joint security with Israel, are 22% right now. And Area C, which is exclusive Israeli control, is 60% of the West Bank. The Gaza Strip, it's a different proportion. But if you look at the maps, you can see that the pockets of self-rule in which Palestinians were to get a state are really Bantustans. There's not much other way of talking about them. They're isolated within a larger Israeli land area. Okay. One thing about the Oslo, though, just to go on with this idea for a minute about what it did, is that Israel does not have to impose, or did not, over the last 7 years, did not have to use military or violence, for the most part, in exerting control. It was more like remote control, so the Palestinians took over certain spheres, and they could simply extend their control over the infrastructure, resources, land, etc., in the West Bank and Gaza. Another point about Oslo that may not be clear to many people, or may at this point, is that of all the international resolutions that apply to the Palestinian issue over the last 52 years, there's a whole body of international law. The only one that is mentioned in the original Declaration of Principles is Resolution 242, which calls for Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Everything else does not appear there. In other words, the right of Palestinians to return to their homeland, condemning Israeli settlements as illegal, talking about the annexation of East Jerusalem as being null and void, etc., etc. All this body of international law was not included. And so Palestinians, again, could see that their rights are not built into this process. Moreover, the provisions of Oslo Accords were never meant to apply and do not apply to issues of final status. This is what's in the news today. Refugees, settlements, borders, water, and security. All these issues are final status. All the provisions of all these accords don't apply to them. So what this means is that Israel could use the 7 years to do what it wanted, to position itself to gain in the final status agreement. And we can easily do away with the issue of the U.S. being an honest broker. It isn't. It's always been on the side of Israel, and both ideologically and politically, and in every other way, backing Israel, also economically. What seems to have brought the issue to the head right now, and why the situation seems to have erupted there at this point, I think is in part related to this background, this foundation that I've just been talking about. But it also relates to the fact that the Oslo process was over. Palestinians and Israelis had to negotiate final status issues. And in those negotiations, Palestinians and I think a lot of others began to realize that far from being this wonderful peacemaker, Barak was not really much different than Netanyahu, except perhaps in different degrees. Over the same issues, refugees, Jerusalem settlements, and so on and so forth, the final status was not going to, again, meet the minimum of Palestinian rights. Palestinians were also getting very fed up with the Palestine Authority itself. I haven't said enough about it. but seeing it as ineffectual and impotent and great on rhetoric and words, but not being able to achieve anything, plus also benefiting itself from the Oslo process. And, of course, keep in mind the daily humiliation and harassment and the poverty in the territories during the last several years. I'll give you one quick example. During the trip that we went on last month, we went into Hebron, which, as you may know, is a divided city. We were walking in the market area, and whoever has been there knows that there's this mesh sort of fence above the market where settlers and the army throw trash on the market below where the Palestinians are. And one person pointed out to some structures, homes. The first level is a Palestinian home, and you can see it's old and the paint is peeling and so on. And then right above it, the second floor, is an Israeli Jewish settlement home. Right there in the middle of the city, crushing the Palestinians, I mean, almost literally. So they're right at each other's throat there, right in the middle of populated Palestinian areas. So it needed, all of this just needed a spark, and the spark was provided by Sharon's visit to the Haram Sharif area. And I think we also need to say a few things about the current situation, that I think that rather than being seen, the Israeli response really needs to be seen in the context of preparation for exactly such a response to any Palestinian moves, either to declare a state unilaterally or in case the peace process did not go the way that Israel wanted it to. So if they couldn't achieve through negotiations what they wanted, Israel had been preparing for several months at least to be able to surround and stake its claims by force. And Palestinians provided this opportunity through their own revolt against occupation. And I think that we need to look at this whole picture as part of this laying claims and staking out territory that Israel is going to integrate into its own state as its answer to a final settlement. Since I'm running out of time, I just want to say a couple of things about... I'm not going to talk about the deaths and the violence and all that. Probably some of you know, or we can talk about it later. But during this whole time, I don't know whether any of you have noticed different pieces of news that have come about. For example, today there was some news in Haaretz about the, this is the Israeli daily paper, about the U.S. going to provide perhaps another $2 billion to Israel over and above its annual $5 billion in aid. Another piece of news over the last several weeks was about three new settlement initiatives in the area where actually I have one of my aunts living near El Biri in the West Bank. A new, as they call it, neighborhood was established as part of the Beit Il settlement. Inside Jerusalem, near the Muslim quarter, a Jewish family moved in and occupied a place there. And in today's Haaretz, I saw this too. If you remember last year with all the fuss about getting those few settlers out of a single outpost after the last Sharm el-Sheikh memo or agreement or negotiations or whatever it was, they went back. So they went back to that same place where they were taken.